All right, we were discussing the meaning of the Hebrew word yom, day, which is on the top of page 2 of your class outline, lecture outline. And we were still under A, usage of the word. A, I divided into two subheads, usage in the Old Testament in general, and then usage in the framework of Genesis 1. And we had discussed the usage in the Old Testament in general, and we were in process, as I recall, discussing usage in the framework of Genesis 1. Just to quickly reorient ourselves, as I mentioned before, it's my view that there are a number of things in Genesis 1 that point toward understanding Yom as a period of time of creative activity rather than a solar day. And among those things I mentioned, the word is used elsewhere in that sort of a meaning. Therefore, that kind of usage elsewhere permits that kind of a view within Genesis 1. Secondly, it's not till the fourth day that the lights become used for a measure of time, so it's not till the fourth day that you would have solar days. We discussed something of the source of light prior to that in our discussion of that. Thirdly, if you take day in the structure of Genesis 1 as a figurative designation then for a period of time rather than a solar day, it would be appropriate to understand the phrase evening and morning as an expression for the beginning and ending of that period of time. We discussed that a bit. And then, fourthly, I think this is where we stopped. We noticed a number of things which took place on the sixth day. Sixth day, you had the creation of animals, you had the creation of man, you had him placed in the garden, you had him given the task of tilling the garden. You had the animals brought to man. He was to name all the animals. We get this by combining information from chapter 2 with chapter 1. He was to name all the animals. In that process, he found none that corresponded to himself. He became aware of that difference between himself and the animal creation. Then the Lord God put a deep sleep on Adam, took the rib from Adam, created woman. And then he gives that exclamation, now at last, bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh, and so forth. Now the question is, did all of that transpire within the light period of a 24-hour solar day? In my view, all that happened there seems to suggest that we're in a longer period of time than simply a solar day. I think that's where we stop. In 2:23 of Genesis, let me see how the NIV works that. 2:23 is, the man said, this is now. I think I mentioned just at the end of the hour that that could better be translated now at length. The Revised Standard Version there says, this at last, finally, bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh, she shall be called bone. Okay, I just want to make one further point then. Under this discussion of usage in Genesis chapter 1. The seventh day, on which God rested from his creative activity, is a day which has lasted for a long period of time. At least this is the way I would view it. And to me, that would parallel the other 6 days as long periods of time. In other words, it seems to me when it says of the seventh day that God rested, he ceased then from his creative activity, and in that sense, that rest has continued from then to the present. So that it seems to me that that's also speaking of a period of time. And the fact that that continues, I don't think that he ceased just for a 24-hour solar day. he ceased from his creative activity and he rested. And he continues to do that with respect to his creative activity. So the conclusion that I would draw from the text of Genesis 1 itself is that there are factors in Genesis 1 that suggest that the word day or yom is to be understood as a period of time of God's creative activity. Period of time of God's creative activity, which is of indeterminate length. I don't think there's any way from the chapter you can tell how long or how short those periods were. I don't think that sort of information is given, but it does suggest that it's a period of indeterminate length. Question?
At this point in the Sabbath day, are you using the Hebrew four passages, or are you referencing?
Well, I think the Hebrew four passage does relate to it, and undoubtedly that is also related to what my conclusion there. But you read on, it's actually, you read it, it's actually in chapter 2, verse 2. The seventh day, God had finished the work he had been doing, so on the seventh day he rested from all his work. And God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it he rested from all the work of creating that he had done. So, you know, we're told that he rested from all the work of creating that he had done on the seventh day. You can just reflect on that text. What's that mean? Does that mean that in a period of seven successive 24-hour solar days, somewhere way back in the beginning of things, that God rested from creative work just for 24 hours, and then he resumed it? Seems to me that what it's saying is that after the 6 days of creative activity, he ceased creating and he rested. Now, of course, you can get into all kinds of implications theologically from that. Probably get into the question of creationism versus traducianism with respect to man's soul. But, you know, how is that life transmitted from generation to generation? Is there a special creative act involved, or is it something that's passed on from parents? You know, a lot of those questions are complex, in which you get very easily into a lot of speculative theology. And I don't know. I wouldn't push this last point. The counterpart of it is, and we'll get to that shortly, is that those who would argue for a 24-hour solar day would also use the analogy of the seventh day to support their case by appealing to Exodus chapter 20 and the analogy of 6 days you work, one you rest. And that's obviously, speaking of solar days, we work 6 days, we rest one. And if God did that, we are to imitate him in that, and therefore he must have rested for a solar day. Now, my response to that would be the analogy is in the 6+1 sequence, not necessarily in the solar day framework. Another question. Ed.
Yeah. Don't think me that from Genesis 2 here mm-hmm. that it necessarily follows that they're still in that 7 day age. You know, mm-hmm. for the creation, it could have gone on to be something else.
I think it's a pointer that supports generally this idea that the word Yom in Genesis 1 does not mean a 24-hour solar day. I don't think you can prove it. I think we're in this whole discussion in an area where there has to be an allowance of difference of opinion and conclusion. I don't think either side can say it must be. Here's what is the constraint of the text. You have to come to this conclusion. I was just giving the reasons that have led me to the conclusion to which I have come. Let's go on to B. We're not done with this discussion. B is main types of views of Genesis, of the days of Genesis 1. Main types of views of the days of Genesis 1. Now, if you glance at your outline, and I want to mention this now so we don't get lost in the discussion. There are two sub-points under that. One is actual days, and two is non-actual days. Now, that terminology might be confusing. I'm not talking about solar days versus period of time when I talk about actual days and non-actual days. If you glance again at your outline sheet, you'll see that under actual days, there's 24-hour solar day view, and there's the period of time of indeterminate length view. They are both actual days, as distinct from a non-actual day view. Now, what I mean by a non-actual day view, we'll discuss in a minute. But first, let's look at the actual day view with those two subpoints. And let me say this also before discussing this a bit further. We shouldn't lose perspective on the importance of this discussion of period of time versus 24-hour solar day. That's not, by any means, the most important piece of information in Genesis chapter 1 and 2. That general teaching we looked at earlier about God, about man, about the universe, I think that is what's important in Genesis 1 and 2. Whether the day was long, in the sense of an indeterminate length period of time, or whether it was short, is really not the big issue. Don't lose sight of that. You know, get all wrapped up in a discussion of this and push its importance way out of perspective. But let's go back to this then. Actual days, first the 24-hour solar day view. There are really three approaches to this. Let me briefly mention them. One would be seven successive 24-hour days. A second would be what we touched on earlier in discussing Genesis 1, the restitution theory, based on the verb become of Genesis 1-2, in which the earth became void and darkness was over the face of the earth, which means that the 6 days of creation are not really creation, but reconstitution. You had the initial creation, and in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. The earth became void. Then you have 6 days of reconstitution, you might say, and all the geologic record, fossils included, by those of this viewpoint, are placed in the time prior to Genesis 1-2. So then you get a reordering, a restructuring in the 6 days of the chapter. But many who hold that view hold to the 6 24-hour day understanding of the days of Genesis 1. A third approach would be what is called an interperiod theory. Interperiod theory. The idea being there were long periods of time between the days of Genesis 1. So that would allow for the geological record to be placed in the framework of Genesis chapter 1. But the days that are spoken of would be 24-hour solar days, interspersed with long periods of time. Yes.
Some people call it like a gap theory.
No, the gap theory would really be another name for that reconstitution theory, the gap between Genesis 1-1 and 1-2. Normally, that's the way that term's used. This third view, interperiod view, Dr. Newman holds a variation, you might say, of this. If you look at his book, which I presume, is that still in the bookstore? Is it still in print? Genesis 1 and the Origin of the Earth? I think it is. Very useful book. You might look at it sometime. I believe that's on your bibliography. Maybe not under this point, but page 6. Oh, yes. In 3A, 6A, next to the last entry on the page, There's an entry there I should have mentioned, which I didn't. R.J. Snow, how long is the sixth day? Appendix 3 in Newman and Eckelman's book, Genesis 1, the Origin of the Earth, IV Press, 1977. That article by R.J. Snow is an interesting and useful article about that sixth day that we just mentioned a few minutes ago. But that's Dr. Newman's book. He suggests that the days are 24 hours each, and that each one opens a new creative period. 24-hour day opening a new creative period. So that he doesn't view the day as a long period of time, but as introducing a long period of creative activity. Yes. I really couldn't tell you. Somebody has to...
We just had that. We just had that. Yom is an actual 24-hour day, but if the day was signified when God pronounced it is good, his creation. But he holds to
a modified inner period view. I think he would have then a long period of creative activity, but finalized by that statement.
It's not finalized by that. It's the end of creation. It's just a period of time when God,
when he spoke it,
identifies it, claims it to be good. And yet, you have to look at natural theology to identify the beginning and the end of the creation, called the creative aspect period, or what we previously would refer to as a day of creation.
Well,
it's an indeterminate thing.
Very similar to Dr. Newman's view, and certainly under this third category, some form of an inter-period theory, but which would hold you a 24-hour day.
Yeah, he claims there is a day, an actual 24-hour day. I guess
my difference with that would be I don't see any necessity myself to conclude that there must be a 24-hour day in the structure of the days of the chapter, and particularly because of that day 4, that the sun and the moon were not placed in position for measurement of days until the fourth day. So what was day 1, 2, and 3? Obviously not a solar day, as I see it. That's the crux of the matter, in my view. But I'm not, as I said before, I don't think this is something that we should get so tangled up in and involved in debating to elevate it way out of proportion as far as its importance. I think the text allows for certain freedom and conclusion because of the lack of clarity. All right, 24-hour day view is what we're discussing. I gave 3 possible alternative conceptions of how that 24-hour day works in the context of Genesis chapter 1. Arguments in favor of the 24-hour solar day view, I think, are the following. First, in its primary meaning, the word yom, or day, means a solar day. In its primary meaning, the word yom means a solar day. That's normally the way we understand it. And certainly if you just come to the chapter and read it, that's probably the understanding, your initial understanding. Yes? The difference would be this. In number 2, where you have, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth became without form and void, you have an initial creation and then a cataclysmic change. The 6 days that follow would be 6 successive 24-hour days in which, that's number 2, in which that chaotic condition is restructured. Geologic time is pushed then back earlier, before Genesis 2. In the third view, geologic time is in the structure of the 6 days, you see, but it's interspersed between these 6 days, rather than pushed back prior to. That's the difference. All right, the first thing then was, the primary meaning of Yom is solar day. Secondly, the phrase evening and morning strengthens that conclusion. I think that's the most obvious initial understanding. Evening and morning speaks of a solar day. is the understanding I was arguing for requires a figurative understanding of that. I don't think that's such an objection that it rules out the day-age view, but it does require a figurative understanding of evening and morning. And then Exodus 29 to 11, what I just mentioned a few minutes ago. In Exodus 29 to 11, 6 days shall you work, and the seventh you shall rest, because in 6 days God created the heaven and earth, and the seventh he rested. The argument on the analogy with Exodus 29 to 11 is that day should be taken in the same sense in both passages, Genesis 1 and Exodus 20. All right, so those are the arguments in favor of a 24-hour solar day. B on your sheet under actual days is the understanding of Yom as a period of time of indeterminate length. And this is often referred to as the day-age view. We've already discussed it. I've given arguments in its favor. So we won't go back into that at this point. But notice that that is an actual day, even though it's a period of indeterminate length. It's still an actual day. It's a period of time in which God did certain things. And there's a sequence in the chapter in God's creative work. Now, with the day-age view, often the objection to it has been raised, is it not a view that has been adopted in an attempt to harmonize science and the Bible? Isn't that the reason for it? Isn't that view just something that's been generated or adopted in order to harmonize science and the Bible? I wouldn't deny that there's a very strong basis for coming to that conclusion. But let me make two comments in that general area. First, I think we have to avoid hostility to science and the tendency to ignore or minimize the importance of its discoveries. We need to avoid hostility to science and the tendency to ignore or minimize the importance of its discoveries. In other words, the Bible should not be an obscurantist. What the Bible believer should not be an obscurantist. What the Bible believer must do is distinguish between well-established scientific facts, on the one hand, and various scientific theories that are really unfounded or philosophically biased. You have to make distinctions. There's a lot that's labeled scientific that's really not scientific. But we should not bury our heads in the sands and ignore or be antagonistic toward the findings of scientific research. Scientists have discovered a lot of things about the nature of reality through scientific investigation. And a lot that scientists have discovered is quite valid. We have to be able to distinguish between what is valid and what's not valid. That's one thing. We should avoid hostility to science and use it discriminatively. But secondly, we shouldn't try to force agreement between scientific theories and the Bible by twisting or forcing statements of the Bible to fit certain theories. Be careful of that. We shouldn't try to force agreement between scientific theories and the Bible by twisting or forcing statements of the Bible to fit certain theories. Now, I think we should always be on guard against that. But having said that, I think at the same time we can say that sometimes scientific discoveries may give pause to re-examine certain biblical texts to see exactly what they say. And often you will find that the text may not be as specific as you may have initially thought it to be. And it's the scientific investigation and conclusions that become the stimulus or the motivation to look again at the text and look at it perhaps more carefully than you'd looked at it initially, and to see in what parameters the text itself allows you to move. I think that's important. I'm sure most of you are familiar with Francis Schaeffer's Genesis in Space and Time. On page 57 of that volume, he's discussing the days of Genesis 1. And I won't read much of his discussion, but at the conclusion of it, he says, "Therefore, we must leave open the exact length of time indicated by day in Genesis." In other words, he doesn't come down hard one way or the other. Solar day, period of time here. Then he says, "From the study of the word in Hebrew, it is not clear which way it is to be taken. It could be either way. In the light of the word as used in the Bible and the lack of finality of science concerning the problem of dating, in a sense there's no debate because there are no clearly defined terms upon which to debate." But I think with Schaeffer, the scientific material has caused him to look again at the text. And then you see the text allows for certain room or freedom there to move in accordance with the scientific data, where they may lead you, without twisting or distorting the text. So I think those things are important. Avoid hostility to science. Don't try to force statements of the Bible to fit theories. But on the other hand, let the scientific discoveries that do seem well-founded, they may well be a stimulus to re-examine the text and see exactly what it says. All right, number two, under types of days, views of days of Genesis 1, is non-actual days. Now, what's a non-actual day? Well, I think we'll see by way of illustration. But in general, this would be a view that sees no real historical connection between the days of Genesis 1 and the sequence or process of God's creative activity. It's a view that sees no real historical connection between the days of Genesis 1 and the sequence or process of God's creative activity. Now, there are a number of varieties of non-actual day view. The first one, which would be small a, is the view of Origen. Origen was a church father from Alexandria, 185 to 253 AD. He viewed the days of Genesis 1 as symbolic of the order of God's creative activity. Symbolic of the order of God's creative activity. He says the creation came to pass in a moment, and the 6 days are merely indicative of a logical order. Origen says, "No one of a good mind can accept that there was actually a first, second, and third day as well as an evening and morning without sun, moon, and stars." He's back into that problem of the fourth day. And he has a point. The creation came to pass in a moment, and the 6 days are merely indicative of a logical order. That's taken from, if you look at page 7 that I just handed out of your bibliography, third entry, Origin on First Principles, Harper and Row, 1966, page 288, where he makes that statement. So that's one variety of a non-actual day view going way back to the early centuries of the church. Augustine also has a non-actual day view. I think you would call it an allegorical type of view. Understanding exactly what he means by some of his statements about the days of Genesis 1 is not easy. But in Buswell's, J. Oliver Buswell's Systematic Theology, Volume 1, this is top of page 7, the first entry there, pages 142 to 144, he discusses Augustine on the creative days. And he says, in Augustine's City of God, book 11, section 6 and 7, he says, what kind of days these are is extremely difficult or perhaps impossible for us to conceive, and how much more to say. That's quoting Augustine. And he goes on to say, morning returns when the creature returns to the praise and the love of the Creator, when it does so in the knowledge of itself, that is the first day. When in the knowledge of the firmament, that is the name given to the sky between the waters above and those beneath, that is the second day. And when in the knowledge of the earth and the sea and all things that grow out of the earth, that is the third day. And when in the knowledge of the greater and lesser luminaries and all the stars, that's the fourth day, and so forth. Now, Boswell comments, it seems that Augustine took the word day in this scripture passage to refer to the spiritual experiences of the creature in returning, quote, to the praise and love of the Creator in view of the various aspects of creation. He comments, we cannot judge Augustine by our standards and rules of grammatical historical hermeneutics. He was notoriously allegorical in his exegesis. We can only note that this great father of the church in the 5th century, probably the profoundest theologian since the Apostle Paul, unquestionably loyal to the Bible, interpreted the days of Genesis' creation record in what seems to us a rather fanciful manner. But it's an allegorical type of view of the days. There are none actual days with respect to any historical sequence in God's creative activity. That's the point. It has more to do with the spiritual experience of the believer in responding to God's creative work. A third category under non-actual day would be the revelational day view. This is what they see. Revelational day view. On your bibliography, down the middle of page 7, you see P.J. Wiseman, Clues to Creation in Genesis, Part 2, Creation Revealed in 6 Days. P.J. Wiseman argued that God revealed creation on 6 days to Moses. So that the days of Genesis 1 are not solar days or age days indicating a time of creation. Rather, they are solar days indicating a time of revelation. And it was creation revealed in 6 days. I find it very difficult to find that in Genesis chapter 1. It seems clearly what's being spoken of is not God's revelation to Moses of what he did on, you know, in 6 days of revelation activity, but what he actually did in his own creative activity. But this view is certainly a non-actual day view with respect to the days of creation. Now, you see what's behind this. This is relatively recent to 1977. I think, again, is this harmonization of science and scripture. If you have a certain sequence in God's creative activity, how do you match that up with what scientists are telling about sequence and what we can find with respect to creation of different life forms? And if you remove sequence from Genesis chapter 1, then you have no longer any problems. Yes? Remove sequence of God's creative activity, it keeps sequence of God's revelatory activity. There could, but there'd be no way to establish it. Could be. Yeah. Is that right? I'm not familiar with him. The next view I'll mention, which is non-actual day view, is the view that's, I would say, most popular among contemporary evangelicals who hold to a non-actual day kind of view. And I'll call that the framework hypothesis. The framework hypothesis, or double symmetry view. Now, let me put this up on the overhead for you.
framework hypothesis or double symmetry view. Probably the most influential advocate of this in English writing is N.H. Ritterboss. That's the fourth entry on page 7. In his little book, Is There a Conflict Between Genesis 1 and Natural Science? Erdmann's 1957. That's a translation from a Dutch book. He later wrote a more extensive volume on the same subject in 1963 that I have listed there in Dutch, but it's never been translated into English. In Ritterboss's view, the 7 days of Genesis 1 are a literary framework into which the creation narrative is set, thus framework hypothesis. It's a literary framework into which the creation narrative is set. In his view, the days are a literary device and are not to be taken as having chronological significance. It's pure and simple, a literary device. There's no chronological significance. They're non-actual days. They're not days that actually took place. It's a framework, a literary framework, to tell the story of creation. Ritterboss says, quote, the 6 days of Genesis 1 are obviously intended as the sum of two tritomes, that is two sets of three, which consequently reveal a clearly pronounced parallelism, while the total arrangement is intended to place in bold relief the surpassing glory of man who attains his true destiny in the Sabbath. Given this plan of the creation account, we may infer, meanwhile, that the author consciously used days and nights, evenings and mornings, as a literary framework. The specific order belongs to the writer's method of work, not God's creative acts. The order belongs to the writer's method of work, not God's creative acts, although it may symbolize the idea that creation is a well-ordered whole. Now you see what he did. He drew a parallelism between the first 3 days and the second 3 days. Day one, you have light, whereas in day four, you have the light bearers, sun, moon, stars. Day two, you have the firmament and the division of waters above and below, whereas in the fifth day, you have fish and birds. How strong the parallelism is something that's disputed. You can perhaps see it there, or perhaps you'll find problem with it. But the third day, you have the dry earth separated from the sea and vegetation, and then you have inhabitants of the earth, animals and man. That leads up to the seventh day of special significance, the Sabbath. Climax is in the Sabbath. Now, let me push that up a bit. You have 8 creative acts. 4 on the first 3 days, 4 on the second 3 days. Which means you have 2 each on the third and the 6 days. Those creative acts are introduced by the phrase, and God said. If you go down through the chapter, you find that phrase, and God said, repeated. You see, in verse 3, and God said, let there be light. So you have it once on the first day. Then in verse 6, and God said, let there be a firmament. That's the second day. Verse 9, and God said, is on the third day. But verse 11, you see, you have 2 on the third day. Verse 9 and verse 11. And then verse 14, you have, and God said. Verse 20, and God said. And verse 21, no. Verse 20 is, and God said, that's the fifth day. And then verse 24, and God said. And 26, you get 2 on the sixth day. So you get 2 each on the third and the sixth day. And a total of 8. So with that kind of a schematic structure to the chapter, the conclusion is drawn that what you have here is a literary device to structure the creation account, and that the days are not actually days of God's creative activity. They're a device of the writer in presenting God's creative works. Question? I'll come to that. Buswell, in his volume one of his Systematic Theology, discusses this view. And on page 143, here's what he says of it. He mentions Ritter Voss's book. And then he says, "I must confess that the alleged symmetry between the two groups of 3 days each seems to me like seeing faces in the clouds. Yes, the faces are really there and can be seen by others to whom they are pointed out, but the question is whether they were intended. What one person sees as a face in the clouds, others may see as an animal or a tree, and the same person may see the same cloud formation, two different patterns, depending somewhat on the way he directs his vision. I'm not at all convinced that Moses, as inspired by the Holy Spirit, intended any parallelism between days 1, 4, 2, 5, 3, and 6. For one thing, if the days are to be matched, it would seem to me that day 3 matches day 5 better than it matches day 6. That's the dotted line there. In other words, if you're going to see a parallelism, he sees dry earth separated from the sea and vegetation more with fish and birds than he does with the inhabitants of the earth, animals, and man. And the parallelism seems stronger between 5 and 3 than it does between 3 and 6. And he goes on, he says, there are other points in which I cannot see the parallelism. He adds, certainly it's not a heresy for one to see or imagine that he sees such an intended parallelism. What I do object to is the inference that the alleged double parallelism in the 6 days of creation somehow or other erases the prima facie order of events enumerated one after another. In other words, what he objects to is getting rid of the idea of sequence. But if you take the days as a literary device that has nothing to do with God's creative activity in 6 days, you have ridded the chapter of sequence in God's creative activity. And of course, that's Ritterboss's point. He wants to do that because you notice the title of his book is there a conflict between Genesis 1 and natural science? And the way he avoids the supposed conflict is by ridding Genesis chapter 1 of any sequence. Now there you get back to this question. Are you forcing something on the chapter that arises out of scientific data that really doesn't do justice to the chapter? I see my time's up. I want to discuss this double symmetry view a little bit further with some other objections that seem to me to be important to this view. And I would say I think this view is important because increasingly evangelicals seem to be latching onto it.